gentlemen, welcome back to the Passion Pit. I'm Jay Michaels, and we spotlight on this program the movers, the shakers, and the indie art makers of New York City and beyond. Now today, that term beyond has particular significance. We have two world travelers with us. These artists make work that are designed to influence people around the world. And their latest work, actually, is designed for and presented during this holiday season. First, we meet one of the major players that uses art to change the world, Ripple Effect Artists, and its founder, Jesse Fahey, have been bringing work to people around the world and designing each show to make a difference. Now, this year, they've chosen climate change. And what better time to talk about resurrection of the earth than right now? Here's Jesse.
Hello.
Jesse Fahey.
Hello.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Fantastic.
It is wonderful to hear from you, and it is always wonderful to be part of the Ripplers, the Ripple Effect Artists Theater Company.
Thank you.
I know you guys a long time, and you guys are like the original philanthropic arts organization. I remember you introducing the company to me many years ago, and I was so vastly impressed. And here you are in leaps and bounds now. You're an equity company, and you are still changing the world one play at a time. Tell us about Ripple Effect, and tell us about yourself.
So thank you so much. That's such a wonderful acknowledgement. So as you said, we are a philanthropic company. We began in 2009, and with each production that we put on in New York, we raise awareness and funds for different human rights causes. So our whole purpose is to really bring the art of theater and storytelling and to merge it with advocacy groups and with advocacy initiatives. So what that actually looks like is with every production that we put on, we have a specific theme that we tackle, and we always use masterfully written, produced works. So it's a lot of familiar works. We've done Clifford Odets, we've done Shakespeare, and many other very important playwrights.
You've done absolutely one of my favorites. You've done The Adding Machine. You did an equity production of The Adding Machine.
Yes, yeah, Elmer Rice. Yeah.
Now you are equal opportunity philanthropy. You pick a different topic and a different charity, different cause. So you really are giving us not only a spectrum, if you will, of art, but you're also giving us a spectrum of what the world needs.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Yeah, I've witnessed many companies take on a specific issue, and that's wonderful. And I really wanted to address every issue possible, because that is what theater does. You know, there's so many plays that tackle and take on so many different kinds of things worth discussing. And so I felt that is what we should do. And we have different organizations come and speak to our audiences after our shows. And then a percentage of our box office will go towards what we call a partnering organization.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
So not only do you create the awareness, but you make sure that there's monetary recompense for these companies as well.
Yeah.
What makes you choose a charity? As much as universal, is there something that makes you say, well, wait a minute, what's important today? Or if this is important to a member of our group, is there a criteria?
Yeah, yes, there is. And it's a great question. And it kind of got created through just experimenting. But now we do have a very specific criteria. So we choose a topic first. So we, as a board of directors that I have, I now have six members of the board of directors, and we look at what do we want to take on this year, what theme. So we have a theme every year. This year it's climate change. Next year we're going to take on immigration. And then we look at, okay, what are plays that will really not only address the theme, but are also very well written. And by well written, I mean plays that really ask a question, plays that really challenge an audience to really think and to cause dialogue. And then we also choose a play that is somewhat well known that will be a great challenge for actors and directors. And then we look at organizations. We do tend to choose organizations that are in New York just so that we know that they can actually attend. And then we also look at organizations that are really very active in the community that would want to participate. Sometimes there are organizations that are so busy that they'll just say, oh, okay, that's great. Here's a third party agreement. And they're not necessarily going to be active with us, which is fine. They might not be the most appropriate, you know, type of organization for what it is we're going to do. And then we want to really find organizations that will be on board with the fact that theater is going to tell their story.
Do you find that being more beneficial? Obviously, you're doing good for a charity. Do you find that their hands-on connection makes it a stronger project in some way?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. The intention is that we as artists feed into whatever the advocacy work is, and that the advocacy work feed into what we're doing. And I think, you know, I'm an artist as well, and all artists should feel some sort of further connection to their art when they're connected to the difference their art can make, or the actual stories that are tied to whatever story they're putting out. You know, we took on human trafficking a couple of years ago, and we had a human trafficking survivor come and speak. And I think just as an actor, hearing a real life person who has been through something as horrific as that, it can feed into your art. And so I think, and then also, of course, us telling those stories, it shows advocacy groups that we not only believe in their work, but that their work, their stories are really worth being told. And I think the real heroes are people who take on this sort of advocacy work. So we as artists get to tell their stories, which I think is really important.
Do you find you get converts within your company? Someone is cast in a show about climate change, about human trafficking, about equality of some kind. And by the end, they're like, okay, no, I want to do more. Can I donate? Can I do whatever?
Yeah.
Have you had converts, in other words?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question, because sometimes people on my board and people around me are saying, are you trying to change people's minds? And I'm not. I don't think that's the most effective route to go. Maybe, my God, if we had somebody who was a climate change denier, and if they were in our audience and all of a sudden they started believing, that would be incredible and a miracle. And I don't expect that. I don't expect that a climate denier would come to this show necessarily. But what I do expect, and the mission of our company, is to move audiences from apathy to action. So I do think that there are issues that people have just grown apathetic about, just because that's human nature. And so when they see a piece of really powerful theater, they think, okay, it's time for me to get on board and do something about this. And I have had that. We had people, when we put on a show about cancer, we had people say, I want to volunteer at the Gilda's Club, which was the organization partnered with. We had people in the audience say, I'm going to volunteer, I'm going to be a part of this. You can't put a price tag on that. That's the reason I do what I do.
Well, yeah. Then you're literally doing your message of changing the world.
So
that's really excellent. Now, speaking of you, you quite humbly said that you're an artist, but you are so much more. You're an author, you're an artist, you're a world traveler on the topics, you're a speaker. You do all these wonderful things. Just getting together with you for this podcast. I'm not sure what country you were in when we first mentioned this, but let's hear about you. Why did you form this company, and what is your message? What is Jesse's message?
Oh, wow. I am in America, just to be clear, as of now. So I began this company in 2009. Before then, I had been an actor. I had done one children's theater tour, and then I worked with some other theater companies here in New York, and I had done some film work and just background work on TV. And I was at that point in my life, I was just so committed. Like, I want to be an actor. I want to be an actor. I want to be an actor. It was the thing I loved since I was 16, and I just knew that was what I was going to do. And then I'm going to admit something. I was at a point where I was making my living as an actor. It wasn't a great living, but I was living off of being an actor, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've made it, you know, like I've arrived. And I really wasn't happy, if I'm going to be completely honest. I was very young, so I was still kind of figuring things out, but I just thought, no, this isn't it. But I didn't know what was next necessarily. So I went to, and then I came home, got a sales job, started making the money that I wanted to make. And then people were introducing all these sort of courses, like personal development courses to me and life courses and meditation. And I kind of thought like, oh, this is kind of, I don't know. I don't know if this is for me. Right. That's what I thought at the time. And then I went to a weekend course at a place called Landmark Worldwide, and it changed my life forever. And I got from that, like, oh, I actually can create my own movement and my own company that will combine all the things, not only all the things that I love, but all the things that will make the impact that I am out to make. So brilliant writing, collaborative efforts amongst actors that work cohesively and work well together, and putting out questions amongst audiences and creating a theater company that makes a difference. I just got it in a weekend, and I just got that that was what I was here to do, and not in a spiritual way. Just I just, although maybe people would call it that, but it just clicked. I just knew that that was what there was for me to do. And I do think that people do find their ultimate joy, fulfillment, peace, nirvana, whatever you want to call it. I do think people find that when they find what they're here for. And I just found out what I'm here for. And so I just never stopped. And I knew nothing about forming a business. I knew nothing about forming a nonprofit in New York. I knew nothing about fundraising. I knew nothing about putting together a board. So
Oh, so you had a
this is,
baptism by fire with this.
yes. So this was literally just make mistakes and keep going over and over and over,
Or
and
Orson
stick
Welles
with
says
it.
fine art, he said fine art is happy accidents.
Oh
So
yeah.
I guess Ripple Effect was one great big happy accident.
Yeah. And there were moments that aren't happy, but
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
but the ultimate happiness is absolutely there for sure. Yeah.
Now you bring up an interesting philosophy. Tony Bennett once said, "You could be a star, or you can be an artist." Do you feel that Ripple Effect made you an artist? That you were being an actor, you were doing it, you were going through the motions, but the real core of being an artist didn't happen until you formed that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, God, there are so many debates about what artistry really is. I think it made me, well, it definitely had me respect what we as artists need to do and how we need to be as respectful as possible, just being on the other side of the table, being the person who is managing the paychecks and managing the business aspect of things. I now see what, looking at things from that perspective, I see what it is that we as artists are responsible to do. And I probably wasn't aware of that when I was an actor. So that's part of it. The other part, though, I think I've gotten very clear on what it is to be a creator. There is, I love that you asked that question because there is artistry in producing. I think many people have this conception that producers just walk around writing checks and that's what we do. And it is just so not the case. There is an art to it. Fundraising is part of it, but also choosing the right team is part of it. Choosing the right project is part of it. Reading a great play and saying, oh, okay, how do I get this off the page and onto a stage? How do I create this? And there's nothing more rewarding and fulfilling, at least for me, than reading an amazing play and then getting that on stage and then looking back and thinking, my God, I just read that play 6 months ago and like, here it is. We created it. There's nothing more fulfilling than that. That in of itself is artistry. So yes, to answer your question.
I saw a Facebook post which I thought was absolutely brilliant. It said, "Who is the next Joseph Papp?" Because when you were talking about the art of producing, in my mind, he is one of the last who made it a real art before it just became terribly businesslike. Do you feel as a producer that you are following in that kind of footstep?
Oh, my God. Well, it's an honor to even be compared to him. Yeah, I mean, you know, he had a different mission, but he definitely thought, he really thought about how are my skills as a producer going to be beneficial to the community, and how can I be creative? And he was so creative. And so much of it is about creativity, you know, creating Shakespeare in the Park as a fully donated thing, as a fully donated commodity, in order to build up community and membership within a company. I mean, my God, what a creative way to give back to New York. I mean, these are loyal theater goers, so give them something they can enjoy for free. And that's one of the many things he did, but he definitely was thinking about community while producing, which is what makes him so extraordinary. So
the question sparked it when I was speaking to you, because yes, he took, you know, here's the art of producing. He took Shakespeare, which most people from the days of high school and college, they immediately shy from, and, uh-huh. and made it, oh, we're in New York, we have to go to Shakespeare in the Park. He made it, he made it like Coney Island. He made it like you're going on the Ferris wheel. And I get the idea Ripple Effect is doing that, and you are doing that with your company, because you're basically saying, okay, we're going to tell you about the Me Too movement, about cancer, about climate change, mm-hmm. about all of these things, but we're going to do it with a play. So you don't think you have to read a brochure or anything like that.
Yeah.
So you're sort of seeping it into the consciousness, which I think is great. Now, speaking
Thank
of
you.
My pleasure. Now, speaking of climate change, this Sunday there is a rousing cabaret at one of the more really opulent spaces, the Triad, and it's the Earth Day Cabaret. So so tell me about Ripple Effect's Earth Day Cabaret.
Sure. So I'm so excited. It's great. So it's at the Triad. Amazing singers. Sandra Bargman, she is somebody who's been singing for quite some time. She sung at Madison Square Garden. She sang with the original production of Cinderella. She's just, and she has her own company as well. And she's also, side note, but quite important, Al Gore has this program where he trains people on how to speak about climate change on his behalf, and they train people. So he's, you know, created this whole education for that. So she's one of his trainees as well in the realm of climate change as well. Yeah, I know. How perfect, right? And she's also an interfaith minister. She's just, you know, she's done everything. Gorgeous voice. She sings blues. She sings Broadway-style musical theater. She sings jazz. And so we have her. We have Rance Wright, who is actually, he's a voice teacher, MFA from Boston Conservatory, which is a major conservatory. Mm. He's worked in casting. He's been a director, another astounding voice. And we have Dylan Adams, who hits notes. He's a man, and he hits notes that I can't hit. So just beautiful singers, and all singing songs that are familiar to us, but do address climate change. And what's really exciting is it's going to be intermingled in with some multimedia. And I won't say what it is because that's a surprise, but it's very funny and very poignant multimedia. So it's really designed this Sunday. Not only is it Easter, but it is Earth Day Eve. And it is designed to really just spark up our awareness, and to also serve as a preview in a way for our show 2071, which opens in August.
Right. And that also is about what I gather from the title. That's about what the world's going to be like then.
Yeah, it is.
There you go.
It's a masterfully written play. It's very well done. It was written by Duncan Macmillan, and it started in the UK, and he wrote 1984, which was just on Broadway. He's written
That's right. Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. So he's a brilliant writer. But what he did with this play particularly is different from what he's done in the past. He took the book 2071, which was written by a climate scientist, and he turned it into a play for stage, but it's a one-man play, and it's a man talking about what the year 2071 is, the year that his granddaughter will be the same age that he is now. So he thinks about, okay, this is the world, you know, my granddaughter will be in at my age, and what will our planet look like? What will our world really look like?
Hmm.
Yeah, so there's definitely, there's a lot of scientific talk, and there's a lot of talk about carbon emissions, which is important, but and it's also quite human. It's quite personal. I can't imagine that scientists, to a degree, must take it somewhat personally if they have grandchildren that they know fully well are going to be living in a world that will be very much underwater. And when people disagree with what they have to say, which not only disagree, but with things that they've actually found evidence for, lots of evidence for, I imagine it must be heartbreaking, and they take it personally, and you see it in this play. So it's quite powerful.
It's a really fascinating angle. I am of a mature age enough that I remember my father at my age and what the world was like then, and, mm-hmm. and what it is now. And when I think about what my grandchildren will look at when they're my age, it's mm-hmm. it's quite startling. It makes me sound very old, but when I sit here and I think of things that are just that were in comic books when I was a kid and then now are in reality, you realize the possibilities of the world, and we all look at it positively, but we have to take a moment and say, okay, if we're not careful, yeah. what is advancement going to do for us negatively? And I guess that play really hits it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Now, the
yeah.
songs this Sunday, you say they're familiar tunes. I gather we're going to hear good old-fashioned Broadway, jazz, standards, blues that all
yes.
have a bent sort of somewhere. Suddenly Stormy Weather is going to have a different meaning and
yes,
things
and
like that.
Hear some rock, too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's all those things and some rock and yes.
So everybody can enjoy it, just
yes.
like you cover every cause. You're also covering every genre for this
mm-hmm.
cabaret.
Yeah, exactly.
Now let's hit something that took my breath away when we first spoke about it. It is on Easter Sunday evening, Passover the first night, and yes, okay, Earth Day Eve. But you hit the two holidays there, and I'm thinking now you have a singing minister. So I'm gathering that's part of the production
yeah.
scheme. Why should we come out? Best way to put it, why should we come out? Okay, we finished our celebrations for the day.
Yeah.
Why are we coming to see this? What connects this to the holidays that it's on?
Yeah, it's a great question. If you are biblical in any way, no matter whether it be Easter or Passover, there are many passages in the Bible that talk about how we need to take care of our earth. So this celebrates that. And also, it's a ton of fun. And I know that many Easter celebrations will be in the afternoon. And by about 5:30, you kind of think like, well, what do we do now? Well, go see a show and support something that is actually quite important and meaningful. There will be people from, so our partnering organization this year is 350.org,
uh-huh.
which is an organization that is just phenomenal, all centered around preventing climate change and providing education for that. So there will be people there in the audience from 350.org, and they are there to answer any and all questions that people might have and to meet with people who might have questions about their organization. So it's something that is supporting them as well. But yeah, we need to have an earth in which to have these holidays be so great. So please come.
This is also a time of rebirth and emancipation and everything
mm-hmm.
starting new. When you mentioned about looking at it biblically, we're looking at a time of total regeneration of renovation within both holidays at this point. So instead of finishing the Seder and then watching the Ten Commandments on TV, you get out there and see this amazing new piece.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What's next for Ripple Effect?
Thank you.
What are you doing? What are they doing? What's next?
Yeah. Well, what's next is also this show, 2071,
yep.
and something we've added to our programming overall with Ripple Effect, which is super exciting. What we've done in the past is we've had one or two shows per year and one or two concerts per year, and then we have our fundraiser event around Valentine's Day. What we're adding this year is for the first time ever, drum roll, we have a film that we're putting out, which is
really
so exciting. Yeah, I'm thrilled. So one of my board members is a filmmaker, and he wanted to create a film about climate change. So we had a bunch of screenwriters submit ideas, and we chose one. It's called Frida, and it's about a sort of similar concept to 2071, but different. It's a film that takes place in the future, so sort of like a dystopian future where someone is locked in their house, and we don't know where they're going to get water from and where they're going to get resources from, and that kind of a world, and
what the
characters do and how they actually cope with it. So it's really like, it's very well written. And the screenwriter, first name's Robin, is just fantastic. And we're actually making this, so a big part of Ripple Effect is providing education for students as well who want to be involved in the arts. So we're making this sort of a mentorship program. We have students working on doing PA work, production assistant work, and working on doing second director, like an AD sort of job.
Right.
So it's very exciting. Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah. So essentially the company is now branching into filmmaking as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So you're getting your message across on every medium possible.
Right.
Oh, that is incredible.
As much as I love, yeah, thank you. As much as I love theater, and theater has such an impact with people, you know, sitting right there in the audience, and film can just reach the masses. So we want to have both. So it's very exciting.
That is, when are you looking to premiere the film?
We are looking to do that also in August as well. So August will be a busy month, and it'll be a hot and busy month.
So it's almost like a festival. It's like a multimedia festival, stage and screen from Ripple Effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes staying in the city in August an excellent choice.
Yes, I agree.
This is great. This is great. Jesse, thank you so much. Wow. I always learn something when I speak to you about Ripple.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I will make sure our readers, I'm still thinking that way because I'm old. Our listeners, know exactly how they can get tickets and where this concert is and what, and how they can get involved in Ripple Effect and make their own Ripple Effect. Thank you so much for this. This is marvelous. Be brilliant over the weekend. Be wonderful. And I look forward to chatting with you about that and about all the projects from Ripple Effect.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jay.
My pleasure.
For your time. Appreciate it.
Quite all right. Ciao.
You too.
Bye.
Joshua Krohn is another world traveler that we're speaking with today. He is a theater and filmmaker. And when the subject compels him to write, he does so. And then he presents his work in diverse locations. Last year's compelling play, Squatters, which had 9/11 at its base, was presented in Europe before coming here, and now, washed in the blood, swept the Hollywood fringe before landing next week in the indie theater scene of New York City. Here's a sample of the play, and then we'll hear from the man himself.
When did you realize what you were hearing?
When my lab partner said, "Those are gunshots."
Your lab partner?
Kevin Pitt.
Kind of stood up for me back there. I mean it. No one did that ever.
Are you going to witness to Kevin?
I don't know what to say, Pastor Jim.
I need you to identify the body.
You know who it is.
It's a routine procedure.
You know who it is!
And Lord, we ask you to prepare Kevin to be washed in the blood.
Joshua Krohn.
Yes.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Hi, Jay. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing well.
You're like my hero. When I grow up, I want to be just like you. Reading your bio, you have been all over the world. You have done amazing things. And what do? You put them on film and you put them on stage. You take amazing moments in history thus far and take them from a very personal point of view. So it's a pleasure to speak to you at the moment. Well, pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks, Jay.
Tell me about the newest project. Tell me about Washed in the Blood.
So Wash in the Blood is a play that I wrote back in 2015, about a month after the shooting at Umpqua Community College in Oregon. There were reports that came out at the time that that the shooter was targeting people who believed in God. So he would point his gun at someone, ask them if they believed in God. And if they said yes, then he would shoot them. If they said no, then he wouldn't. It's not clear whether or not this actually happened. You know, there have been conflicting reports about that, but some of the students were reporting this. When I heard that, as someone who grew up religious myself, I kind of put myself in their shoes, and I was very moved by the idea that someone would be capable of, especially at that age, of being able to say yes to that question, knowing that they're going to die. So that's where the idea for this play came from. I put a young student in a school shooting scenario, and he's essentially confronted with, you know, a situation sort of like Peter when Christ was arrested, where he has to choose whether or not to deny, you know, his the person that he's been following and save himself or not. You know, and so that's essentially the point of departure for this production.
Wow.
I did it at the Hollywood Fringe 3 years ago, and I've just now taken it to New York, and we're about to premiere it a week and a half from now.
This is the second time you've done that. I recall last year you did Squatters, which was two individuals in one of the buildings along the Trade Center area that was damaged, and that did very well. I remember all about that show, and that was quite powerful. And again, you brought that to the Hollywood Fringe, I believe, and then it came to New York.
Actually, in that case, I did that show and I premiered it in Berlin. I was living in Europe at the time, and then I took
told
it
you
to
traveled
London.
Everywhere. You did it in Berlin.
I've lived abroad for a while. That's true. And I went back to the. I moved back to the States about 5 years ago. I settled in L.A. I was there for about 4 years, and then I came out to New York. But Squatters was a 9/11 project. I was living in New York when that happened. When 9/11 happened, I was deeply affected by it, like so many other people.
Sure.
And about 6 years later, while living in Poland, I wrote the script Squatters, and then I finally produced it in Berlin and took it to London. And then I had the opportunity to do it when I moved to New York here just last September.
That one was not in California. That one was international before it came here.
No, yeah, that one I never actually did in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Wow. But still, wow. Very cool. What's your mission? Because this is really interesting. You take these very seminal moments in history or historic topics, in this case, it's school shooting. You take it from a very personal point of view. And what's your mission? Is that something, are you looking, what's the creative process? What do you start with? What makes you sit down and write a play or a film?
Well, I think probably the common thread in all of the things that I've written, at least since 9/11, whenever an event happens that moves me powerfully, I really feel something about it, and I need to get those feelings out. That's almost always been the motivation for the things that I've written more recently. And the more that I started to write about things like 9/11, terrorism, like my first feature was about a potential terrorist. The more I've written about these subjects, the more I've become fascinated with what I see as kind of the underlying problem, which is that, you know, violence begets violence. That when there's a violent person, there's almost always violence in their past. And where does that violence come from? So I've several of the projects that I've done, and this is one example, Washed in the Blood. It shows how, you know, violence at home, for example, can lead to violence at school, which can lead to like a much higher level of violence in the form of a school shooting or someone becoming a terrorist or something like that. So I think that's, I certainly don't set out with the goal of illustrating this point, but I think it's the more I look at what I have written, that seems to be kind of like a common theme. As far as what inspires me, it's usually a desire to sort of understand the mentality, the psychology of people who are capable of committing these kind of acts, because I think we need to understand why it is that they're doing these things rather than, you know, sort of making them out to be monsters whose acts are incomprehensible. We need to understand why they do these things so that we can prevent them from happening. I don't think I don't think the right approach is to, for example, just disarm everyone so that no one can harm each other. I think we really need to understand why it is that people want to harm each other in the first place and see what we can do to address that issue.
That's exactly right. A school shooting is something that hits me as I'm talking to you from my office on a campus. So needless to say, something like that sticks to me personally. Now the plotting you have, which is amazing. It is someone who is targeting people who believe in God, you know, which is the exact opposite of what one might imagine. In your own opinion, what makes a school shooter? What makes someone go into a classroom, a movie theater, or anything like that, a public place with a gun, to get rid of innocent lives? What do you think is underneath there? Are there particular signposts that we should look for? What's underneath that makes someone do that?
Okay, so I understand that. So you're asking me, what can we look for in order to prevent? See, I'm actually trying to go a step further. Like, how can we prevent that person from ever even getting to that point in the first place?
Right.
As far as like what the signs are, I think it's really difficult to tell because usually it's a guy who, on the surface, is just kind of quiet and keeps to himself, and that could be 50% of the population. It's just an introvert. You
know? Right.
I really don't think there are usually going to be clear indicators, and I certainly wouldn't want to live in a society where the moment somebody draws like a drawing that seems a little bit threatening, then he gets sent to a counselor and medicated.
Oh, right.
Or something like that. Yeah, I think what they all have in common is that they have a history of violence in their past that was inflicted on them. Like Jung's quote that I used in my play Solitaire is the first thing I did in Los Angeles, and it was about the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. Mm. Jung had this fantastic quote where he says, you know, it's usually the tortured that become torturers. And I think that is very true. So, for example, if somebody's abused by their parents when they're young, if they're abused by their classmates, kids that are bullied, and the problem, you know, the solution might not be to crack down more on bullying and create like this society where everyone's terrified to say or do anything to anyone else. I think the question more is why do people want to bully? You know,
right.
Don't create a police state where nobody can bully anybody, but create a state where people don't feel this need to bully each other. What is it that makes them want to do that? And then it escalates because if you're a kid who can't express their feelings, hasn't been taught how to express their feelings properly, that's usually what happens. You got a kid who keeps everything bottled up inside of him, and then it just explodes in some horrific, violent form. And it could happen in high school, or it could happen 15 years later when he joins an extremist group and carries out something, you know, a much more large scale.
That's a really valid point. Now you're doing this play for a very short run. You're doing it for about 3 days. Mm-hmm. And this was the same as Squatters. Now, because from my hypotheses, your plays travel the world on these limited runs. Is this an international gestation? Are you seeing the play in action with different audiences and things for bigger things, or do you just enjoy the quick burst? Are you looking to take these shows further? I guess is my question.
Thanks. I guess business acumen when it comes to producing, you know, I have a day job as a translator. So that's been my source of income for the last 12 years since I finished studying philosophy. Not a very lucrative field, obviously, to be in. Translation's fine. And I've been able to support myself and save enough money where I could do a production, for example, once every 6 months. And yeah, part of the reason why I've done these shorter runs is because they were what I was able to afford. Especially doing theater in New York, you've got to deal with, you know, rent is expensive. Everything is just much more.
Oh yeah.
What I'm trying to do with these two shows is I want to pair them up because I've done, you know, I did a short run of Squatters in the fall.
Right.
And I'm doing this one now for a weekend. And the idea is there are theaters that actually will do a split with you. One of them is it's called The Tank. They handle a lot of serious subjects. Very, very nice venue. So I was thinking that, you know, if I can get some good reviews on this show, and then we try to take it to The Tank and maybe do a full run of basically a doubleheader. We do both shows in the same evening.
Very cool. So yes, this is sort of a gestation. Here it is now, and the hopes are for a bigger or more powerful run. I think that's great. I think that's really great. And it's welcome to New York. It's very smart. It's very smart to do that, to give it its moment. What's next for you? Where are you going from here?
Well, I spent the winter after I did Squatters. I usually find that when I do a play, I've got theater in my head, and so I'm really kind of charged up to write something new. So over the winter, I worked on two pieces. I wrote a play about Hiroshima, the bombing of Hiroshima, and we're coming up against the 75th anniversary in 2020. So I've been I've written a play that basically explores the kind of the relationship. On the one hand, it explores the relationship between the pilot of the Enola Gay, which dropped the atomic bomb, Paul Tibbetts, and his Robert Lewis, his co-pilot, and it basically pairs them with a Japanese American who's the daughter of the co-pilot and a Japanese prostitute who was a survivor of the bombing and was forced into prostitution because of the deformities that she suffered as a result of the explosion. So this play kind of explores the different sides of the debate on whether or not the U.S. should have done it. What Tibbetts in particular, I find a fascinating character, because here we have someone who many probably perceive as a monster. You know, he dropped a bomb over a city of innocent civilians and killed countless people and never apologized for it and always defended his actions. So I read a lot about his reasons for why he did what he did. I watched a lot of interviews with him. I found him a really interesting character. His perspective is represented. At the same time, we have the Japanese perspective, and then I have the figure of the co-pilot, who in reality actually became an artist later in life. He did this sculpture in marble called God's Wind, and it's like a sculpture in marble of a mushroom cloud with like blood dripping out from the bottom. So to me, here was someone who was kind of in the middle. He had some regrets about what he had done, and he sort of turned to art therapy as a way to deal with it. So the play kind of explores these different attitudes towards the event. And that's something that I would like to do either in Los Angeles or in New York for the 75th anniversary of the bombing. Possibly even try to do it in Japan.
Options
for that. That would be, to actually go to Hiroshima and do that in August when the bombing actually took place.
Oh, I just got chills hearing that.
But imagine the dialogue that you could have with descendants of survivors, or maybe even a few survivors.
And you're basically doing it at ground zero. Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I always imagine in 10, 20, 30, 50 years, whatever, there's going to be so much art and so much commemoration. And I could see so many things done at our own ground zero at the Trade Center. So to hear this, it's really an intense piece. That's really excellent. Big question. I asked this not long ago of Jesse Fahey, who works with Ripple, who founded Ripple Effect Artists, and their whole thing is a philanthropic mission. Tony Bennett once said, you can be a star, you can be an artist. Do you feel, and I'm asking this obviously because of your breadth of work, do you feel that to be a real artist, you have to have something much deeper in what you're doing, that there are actors and there are artists? Do you think adding something like this, adding these deep missions that you're doing, elevates you as an artist? Do you think it elevates your work to focus on such things?
Yeah. I mean, some of my favorite writers, were proponents of art for art's sake. I love Oscar Wilde. There is definitely something to be said for not trying to make art into philosophy, but that's just my particular bent. I mean, partly because that's what I studied, and I studied it because that's what I was always drawn to, and I was drawn to it because I was raised religious and abandoned religion at some point, and so I had this kind of ideological vacuum that I had to fill. So, I mean, for me, if I write something that has, like, I can't write anything, I can't really get into something unless it has some element that is that kind of soul searching. Like, if there is nothing in it for me when I'm writing where I'm kind of seeking answers while writing, because that's almost always what drives me. It's like after the event, I feel horrible about something that happened. I want to understand why. And so I write something in an attempt to understand. So But that's just me personally. I mean, like, not everybody needs answers all the time. I mean, some people accept the fact maybe they were raised to believe that life is meaningless and they've just accepted it at an early age, and they don't have that need for answers all the time. And so for them, art is really something that just exists to make life worth living, you know, and they don't need to find answers through it. So I don't think that it necessarily is an essential element of every great work of art, but I do feel like that when I try to create something just for the sake of creating it and it doesn't have that drive, then it usually feels kind of shallow and kitschy to me. So I don't even try to do stuff like that. But that's, again, that's just me.
You sort of hit a point. You say art it's just for the fun of it. But it isn't, maybe even that's the message itself, to feel better about something by watching it, by exploring it, by looking at a beautiful painting, by looking at a beautiful play, and listening to a beautiful song. Maybe to some it's as much as looking up to the sky and thinking heavenward. So maybe it's something like that. This is the second time you mentioned about religion and your feelings on it. Now theater, as you know, it started as a religion. The Greeks, their religion essentially was the theater. Do you think that even to those who just go see the Happy Musical, whatever, that there's still, and you said it you needed something to help fill a void in you. Do you think that art fills that void in people the way even religion did back then? That's why they're so connected in so many ways. Do you think that art, even to those who just love Oscar Wilde or Cole Porter like I do, it fills a void. It fills the same sort of need. It's sort of that communal feeling, if you will.
I think it definitely does. I would draw, the distinction that I would draw would be between food that actually nourishes and food that tastes good while you're eating it. right. So, I mean, you know, for example, I love junk food like anybody else. And I'm not going to compare Oscar Wilde to junk food, but there is a kind of confection level to it, right? Like you know, you eat something, it's like a delicious cake. It's an amazing work of art that it was made and whatever else. But if there's, you know, if it ultimately doesn't satisfy you, like, who's the guy that did the news on Saturday Night Live for a really long time? You know, not Kevin Nealon, but the one before that.
Dennis Miller. There was Dennis Miller. There was Chevy Chase.
It wasn't that old.
Sorry.
Anyway, he had a great quote. He was talking about how some comedians make you laugh, but there are a select few comedians that actually leave you with something. And he said, you know, it's one thing to make people laugh, but it's another thing to make them smile. And I think there is an effect that you can get from a work of art that's very short-lived. And I feel like a lot of cinema does this.
Mm-hmm.
Film is very good at being very compelling in the moment. But I almost always walk out of a movie feeling like, yeah, but so what? Like, I take nothing with me. I might remember a few things. Whereas, like, at the theater, when I go to the theater, I'm often bored and frustrated and wishing things were a little more this or that. But I never regret that I went, with a few exceptions. Because there's just something about the experience of theater that nourishes the soul. And a theater that really seeks to connect with the audience and like, really seeks to challenge our preconceived notions. You know, even if it fails, it still somehow stirs something in me and makes me feel like my time was well spent.
There you go. So the soul
nourishing.
Yeah,
the musical. I mean, I enjoy a musical too, and it's not, you know, it's not. Again, I'm not trying to be like, I'm not condemning that type of entertainment or anything like that. But I the question is, like, in the limited amount of time that I have on Earth, with the very limited resources that I have to put into, like, what am I actually going to do? And for me, in order to justify the amount of work that goes into something, I have to feel like there's like a deeper meaning behind it.
So when they go see a Joshua Crone piece, yes, they're going to laugh, they're going to smile, they're going to feel, and they're going to walk away with something to think about.
I hope so. And the other thing is, because here's what I've been working on for years. I think it was Goethe famously said of Mozart's Magic Flute that what's so great about it is that it's an entertaining piece that everyone loves and that, you know, the average person can enjoy, but But for those who are indoctrinated into the mysteries of alchemy or whatever else, they can actually get a deeper meaning out of it. And I've kind of made that a sort of guiding star for me in the work that I do. The idea is to sort of create a piece that's entertaining to everybody. And for those who want to look deeper, there is something deeper there for them.
That's great. That's great. So you're handing us all something to think about, whether we want to think about it or not. That's great. Joshua, thank you so much. It's a learning experience always speaking to you. Good luck with the show. May it be brilliant. It opens next week. I'll make sure the listeners know exactly when and where to get tickets and the performance dates and things like that. And I wish you the best with it. And here's to you traveling all over the world, spreading your message.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
Okay. Bye.
Starting next week, we'll be talking to some of the most visible and powerful works premiering in May in New York City, culminating with, well, I'll just say, it'll be Miller time in May. Talk to you soon.